You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jammed Up, a new book by Robert J. Kane and Michael D. White, describes one of the largest studies of police misconduct ever undertaken in the United States, a survey covering over 20-plus years at the New York Police Department that looks at why, how, and where cops commit misdeeds and the role that the department plays in their getting jammed up. It is published by New York University Press and brings Robert J. Kane to our show today. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
Now, the TV show NYPD Blue used that term, jammed up. Is it a term that's used in real life NYPD?
Yeah, when I was there collecting the data for the study, that was the ubiquitous term for officers getting into trouble by the organization. It's sort of a jammed up is a term used when the organization recognizes that the officer has been doing something wrong.
One theory about cops who engage in criminal activities is that they're rotten apples who end up rotting the barrel. But you say that sometimes the barrel itself is rotten.
Well, it's interesting because the NYPD historically has experienced these roughly 20-year cycles of scandal and reform. And, you know, it's a giant organization, obviously, nation's largest. And so There have been periods in the history of the department where it seemed like, you know, half the department was on the take or, you know, doing engaging in profit-motivated misconduct. And so, you know, some folks have argued that, you know, it's a few officers doing the misdeeds. And that's probably true for most of the kinds of misconduct. But when it comes to the big, you know, scandalous misconduct, very often that's a barrel issue.
Although not every cop will succumb. So don't some cops become criminals simply because of their personal characteristics?
Yeah. One of the, you know, major findings of the study really is it's kind of a sort of almost proves the old adage in criminology that the best predictor of bad behavior is prior bad behavior. And that's exactly what we found when we were doing the research and looking at the data was that in their previous lives as regular people, police officers who had gotten in trouble at work or maybe held a lot of jobs, or certainly had a lot of criminal justice contacts, arrests, were the most likely to engage in misconduct.
It's also a matter of education and some other aspects of life.
Yeah, education is interesting. That's one of the trickier predictors, I guess, of misconduct. Certainly, what we found was officers with formal post-secondary education was a protective factor. What's interesting about that, though, is I've looked at the data since then, actually.
But you mean college or some kind of
college
post-high school education?
That's right. So mostly college. However, I will say this. There seems to be something about getting a degree. So some college but not finishing does not protect officers.
Also, if you're divorced or separated?
Yeah. So the flip side to that is if officers get married or come to the job married, they tend to have fewer problems down the road in the police department.
Now, who designed and conducted this study? This wasn't done by the NYPD itself, was it?
No. This was done in a collaboration with the NYPD. I was in graduate school at the time at Temple University. My dissertation advisor, Dr. Jim Fife, who had been an NYPD officer for a long time and was an academic at that time, he designed the study largely, and I helped him design it. And in the latter stages, we submitted a proposal to the National Institute of Justice, federal government. They agreed to fund the study, and so the NYPD gave us access to all of its historical data.
Although in the past, haven't they strongly resisted sharing their files?
Yeah, as far as I know, no other team of researchers has gotten access to personnel records and personnel files.
Of course, this takes place. The study covers the past. You examine a period between 1975 and 1996, but it was a period between two major scandals: the one involving Frank Serpico that resulted in the Knapp Commission report, and the corruption scandal that led to the publication of the Mollin Commission report. Why did you feel that was a good time to study?
That's a good time because it was the most recent The Knapp Commission and the Mullen Commission were the most recent anchors of that scandal and reform cycle. So you have a period right after the Knapp Commission where the department is probably at its most vigorous in terms of detecting and trying to protect against police misconduct. And then as we move away from that into the 80s, you would assume to some extent that the officer would, the department would kind of relax some of those standards, and then you would see misconduct kind of creeping back into the agency.
Well, didn't the force lay off 11,000 officers in the late 70s? Was that because of economic pressures or because they were getting rid of the bad apples?
No, that was economic. Basically, in 1975, New York City went broke, and it laid off 12,000 officers, and then ultimately it attrited by another, 10,000.
So did that have an impact on the annual rates of career-ending misconduct?
They tended to decrease during that time, the annual rates of misconduct.
Fewer cops, fewer misdeeds.
I think so, yeah. That's the impression I have.
And then, of course, every politician says, I'm going to increase the force, and they did that between 80 and 84. 12,000 people hired rapidly, so fast that background investigations weren't always conducted or weren't conducted in enough depth?
Yeah, that's a fascinating history, by the way, in the NYPD, because in about 1981, when the city emerged from its fiscal crisis, the police department began to rapidly hire and also rehire previously laid off police officers. And it seems to me that Gramercy Park, the police academy, just simply couldn't keep up with either training the cops and supervising them properly, the recruits, I should say, or conducting the background investigations.
Well, wasn't there a congressional investigation during that time into brutality on the force?
Yeah.
But that kind of led to the hiring of Benjamin Ward as police commissioner.
Right. Brutality is a tricky one, though. You'll notice if I'm sure you've reviewed the book, and for folks who want to take a look at it, brutality is a tricky one because that is one of the most difficult types of misconduct, I guess, to prove at an acceptable level, because the use of force is a tool we give police officers. So they might misuse it, but certainly they're allowed to use it. And misconduct, profit-motivated corruption, for example, much different.
So we have to find a place where we draw the line. Yeah. But there is a slippery slope here.
Yeah.
My guest is Robert J. Kane, who with Michael D. White has written a book called Jammed Up: Bad Cops, Police Misconduct, and the New York City Police Department. Who were the Buddy Boys?
The Buddy Boys were a group of police officers in the 77th Precinct who engaged in I want to say small scale. It's never small scale when people get hurt, but they engaged in sort of discreet misconduct activities within their precinct. And that was an interesting group because they started out as a group that would engage in what some people might call sort of loyalty kinds of corruption, where they were meeting out street justice to drug dealers and folks they thought wouldn't be sanctioned by the criminal justice system. But after a while, they converted to actually stealing money from drug dealers, dirty money, as they called it, which they make a distinction between dirty and clean money. And stealing money from drug dealers, but then engaging in, street crime as well. But I think that most folks there's a really good book on Buddy Boys, by the way, that we don't cover the Buddy Boys too much in this book.
But was it just one precinct? Or
yes.
Did it turn out that similar activities were happening throughout the department?
At that time, it's hard to determine. At that time, it seemed like that scale of misconduct in the 77th was probably, a concentrated misconduct activity.
Now, where is the 77th located?
Mostly in Bed-Stuy.
And you've discovered that there are differences in police misconduct depending on the neighborhood.
That's right.
Well, I mean, we've been hearing about stop and frisk more recently, which seems limited to minority neighborhoods, despite the fact that, as people have pointed out, there's drug dealing in affluent neighborhoods. There are people with concealed weapons in affluent neighborhoods. But we only look at these things in poor neighborhoods.
it's one of the most vexing public policy issues, I think, going. And that is that in some of the most disenfranchised, socially and legally marginalized neighborhoods, these are places that need the most protection from the police. But in some cases, they also need the most protection from the police.
And this didn't just begin when Bill Bratton adopted the zero tolerance strategies, did it?
Which part, the stop and frisk?
The stop and frisk, did that actually begin at that time?
No, I mean, stop and frisk is a common tactic or strategy used by police departments to, you know, try to find more serious felons. And I would say that the stop and frisk, if we can call it an overall strategy, probably began as police departments began adopting that broken windows approach after the 1982 article.
You write that too much aggressive policing can backfire, but then you say too little can undermine police legitimacy. So how do cops find the right balance?
Look, it's an incredibly difficult job to be on the street, and it's an incredibly difficult job to manage those who are on the street. And you know, police departments, like governments, by the way, have to appear to be doing the right thing. And sometimes that means aggressively enforcing the law, and sometimes it means backing off and not appearing as though you're an occupying force.
What happens when street cops' ideas of good policing clash with what their superiors think is good policing?
That is one of the trickier aspects of all of this, too. When we were doing the research for this, in fact, we would conduct focus groups with different levels of the chain of command in the NYPD. And, you know, we would ask pretty basic questions, things like who are the heroes of the organization, who are the villains, and what is good policing? And we would normally, at the street level, we would get much different answers from beat cops than we would from supervisors. Okay, supervisors said the good cops are those who go out and they do a good job for us, but they don't expose us to liability and complaints. Whereas the line officer said a good cop is someone who has my back when I get into a jam.
So, although you don't define good policing here, and I wondered why not, you do seem to suggest that it is malleable.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time talking about police misconduct. We're certainly not the first researchers who have undertaken this kind of work. There are few researchers out there, though, and even policymakers, who are trying to define good policing. And I believe, by the way, that bad policing and good policing are not on the same continuum.
Well, the good policing only come from the bottom up? Because in the foreword to the book, Professor Candace McCoy writes, we should develop good apples. I'm not even sure what that means.
I think what Candace is talking about is a big piece of this is trying to screen in folks who we think would make good police officers and help contribute to an overall culture of good policing.
What did the Knapp Commission mean by a meat eater and a grass eater?
So the Knapp Commission found that there were some officers who vigorously looked for and exploited opportunities for police misconduct, and they were the meat eaters. They were the ones who were essentially going out and looking for the drug dealers to turn over and start, you know, engaging in arrangements, payoffs.
Now, do we know whether they entered the force with that in mind? Because you suggested that if they had some kind of criminal activity before they entered the force, they were more likely to conduct it once they were in the force. But do you get the feeling that a guy comes into the force and then discovers that this is possible? There are opportunities. Perhaps some fellow officers are doing something similar and then becomes a meat eater?
I think that could definitely occur. We have a chapter in here on trying to apply standard criminological theory, mainstream criminological theory, to the kinds of misconduct you're describing. And so if we take a step back from the police a little bit and just kind of look at that, the development of criminality in general, you know, there are things like self-control. If self-control hasn't been developed by a certain age, you're going to be somebody who has a hard time controlling your impulses, and it may be that if you get a job as a police officer, you'll immediately start to exploit those opportunities.
My guest is Robert J. Kane, professor and director of the program in criminal justice at Drexel University, as well as senior research fellow at the Center for Violence Prevention and community safety at Arizona State University. He has written with Michael D. White, who's an assistant associate professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Arizona State University, associate director of the Center for Violence Prevention and Community Safety at that university. They have collaborated on a book called Jammed Up, Bad Cops, Police Misconduct, and the New York City Police Department. It is published by NYU Press, and we will continue our conversation. I asked about the meat eaters when we come back. I want to know about the grass eaters. We're back with Robert J. Kane, who has written with Michael D. White, Jammed Up, Bad Cops, Police Misconduct, and the New York City Police Department. It's published by New York University Press. So we were talking about the meat eaters. Those are the serious criminal types. What about the grass eaters in the police force?
The grass eaters were officers who were essentially paid to cooperate and not cause any problems for the organization as it engaged in its organized misconduct, profit-motivated misconduct. So they would be paid what was called the PAD. They would be paid often weekly or sometimes monthly, but I think usually weekly, given envelopes.
Wait, money would come in to the precinct.
Yeah.
And somebody would then divvy it up?
Yeah, there were designated folks, officers who would do that.
So you really, these cops are just being paid off not to to report misconduct by other officers.
That's right. That's right. That was Serpico's issue. They were asking him more or less to be, I mean, before the term was invented, more or less to be a grass eater and be quiet.
Now, what would you describe just the kind of stuff that we associate with perhaps crossing the line, officers accepting free cups of coffee? Yeah. Do they get fired for that? Is that considered a gateway beverage with... The theory is that accepting gifts will lead you to wanting more and more?
That's, you know, you're starting with one of the hot-button topics there. Should a cop take a cup of coffee if offered? There are good reasons to take a cup of coffee, and there are probably some good reasons not to, of course. You know, I think that for my purposes, I would probably set the threshold a bit higher than that.
You write about the odd charge brought against Mitchell Tisdale, who was dismissed for failure to safeguard a weapon. What happened to him?
So this was, and that's a pseudonym, but this was, you know, an officer who, actually this is kind of a collection of a few different officers, frankly, but this is someone who the organization thought was a problem and not to be trusted as a good police officer out there to make good choices. And so when he wasn't charged criminally because maybe there wasn't enough evidence against him, this is a case where the police department looked for, you know, reason administratively to get him out of the organization.
When people enter the force who probably shouldn't, is anyone on the force held responsible for allowing them in?
Boy, that's a good question. So the only way I know of, you know, to really impose that kind of accountability would be through a patterns and practice lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. But nobody is questioned, you know, how did this guy get onto the force?
I imagine that in some police departments there are these committees perhaps or units where they sit around and try to figure out what the heck happened here and how is it that this guy is on this job. And I would also say, by the way, that would be if we want to think about how to identify officers who may become problematic down the road, this is a multi-level approach that requires a systemic, you know, intervention.
How can we identify cops who are prone to violence?
Well, that's a difficult one as well. If you think back to what happened, you know, in Los Angeles, the Rodney King, not the Rodney King beating, in Los Angeles, just with the shootings in the 1990s, you know, the Christopher Commission found that, you know, a very small number of police officers was responsible for a large proportion of the violence. And violence is a tricky one to predict.
So Rodney King or locally Abner Louima,
right.
They just were unlucky they got the wrong cops?
to some extent, they were lucky. They were unlucky. They got the wrong cop. Sometimes, you know, in the case of Louima, for example, this was a you know, policing is a very isolated occupation. It's unlike other occupations in that regard. So, the wrong collection of officers working a detail together can be problematic.
Well, is the debate here similar to the arguments we've been hearing over the use of torture for suspected terrorists to get them to talk?
I'm not sure in the Louima case. Louima was not in our data set, by the way, but I'm happy to chat about it a little bit.
Amadou Diallo?
Yeah, so, well...
Sean Bell?
Right, so go to Amadou Diallo for a second. That's an interesting one because Amadou Diallo was a case where you had a car, anti-crime car, where the officers who were in that car had very little experience, okay? So this is a case where a police department more or less had trouble staffing its anti-crime units with officers with a lot of experience. So set that aside and compare that to Abner Louima. That was a pretty horrific case where it appeared that serious malice was involved against this guy.
You found differences in misconduct in the eastern part of the country and the west.
Yeah.
Rodney King wouldn't have occurred here?
No. It's when we think about historic patterns. You know, historically, the East Coast, large cities in the East Coast, the big port cities, generally have been characterized by the profit-motivated stuff. On the West, you know, in the West or, you know, cities on the West Coast, for example, those that are newer, like Los Angeles or, you know, other cities, Phoenix, for example, these are places that have tend to have fewer police officers per capita and where it historically it's been less patronage oriented. And because of this, a lot of departments would argue that they have to be more aggressive to manage the territory they cover. And as a result of this, we sometimes hear about violence increasing because of that.
My guest is Robert J. Kane, K-A-N-E, who with Michael D. White has written Jammed Up, Bad Cops, Police Misconduct, and the New York City Police Department is published by NYU Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There's also legal abuse, isn't there, which often involves the so-called Dirty Harry problem?
Yeah, so the Dirty Harry problem occurs when police officers will use violence as a means to justify an end.
Mm-hmm. But then they lie about it. So that can involve police perjury, and are cops punished when it's found that they lied in court?
Sure. In fact, the popular term is testa-lying. In fact, I mean, it's I wouldn't say it's ubiquitous by any means, but that's if we're talking about misconduct, that's actually a fairly common form.
Have cops been dismissed because of racial profiling?
That's usually at the department level. If it was found that a police officer violated somebody's rights or otherwise abused them, then they would certainly be held accountable.
I want to come back to something we kind of touched on before. Haven't you focused on the so-called opportunity structure for police misconduct in disadvantaged communities in this book?
That's right.
What does that mean?
Well, so I published a series of papers, actually, after I left the NYPD as a researcher. And I was really interested in how the police fit into communities in New York City. So one of the things I found was that the more disadvantage there was, social and economic disadvantage there was in a community, the more likely the police officers were to engage in misconduct. And I think part of this has to do with the opportunities. Opportunities exist because these typically tend to be higher crime neighborhoods where, you know, there's more public crime and more public drug dealing. So there's opportunities there. But also these are also neighborhoods in which the public has a harder time than in other communities holding the police accountable for their actions.
And it's been suggested that in some cases they're really keeping people in their place. There's that whole hypothesis of minority group threat. And then there is the benign neglect hypothesis. And that applies to the way police react to different areas?
Yeah. These are interesting concepts, actually. The minority group threat is a thesis that I have actually tested a few different times in both New York City and in D.C. And this is one of these arguments that, you know, the police will step up their enforcement tactics when they or others in the community feel like they're being invaded, for lack of a better term, by members of non-white groups.
But there were black cops in the force. Do they engage in these activities as well?
Well, this is what's difficult. When I was in the NYPD, for example, doing the research, I would sit, you know, with the commissioner and others, and we would talk about, the kinds of misconduct that were going on and how to manage their disciplinary system, for example. And I never once heard the police commissioner say, "Yeah, we've got to start arresting, you know, the folks who are moving into the, you know, upper east side or something." I think it's much more subtle than that, and I also think that a lot of this comes from the ground up, where maybe there are business leaders in the community who may see folks who don't historically fit the pattern of that neighborhood, and they get a little scared, and they may tell the beat cop, "That guy's doing something that shouldn't be done," or they'll tell a lieutenant. So then pretty soon the lieutenant says, "Hey, we need to pay more attention to this group, skateboarders, you know, whatever."
Well, does it apply differently when the people are African-American, Latinos, Asians?
Kind of depends on the city, actually, from what we've discovered. My work here in New York, for example, has found that the minority group threat is not that salient for the African-American population, but it is has been for the Latino population.
Well, didn't you find that African-Americans were three times as likely as white officers to be dismissed for misconduct, while Latinos were twice as likely as white officers to be dismissed? Is that because they're more likely to engage in wrongdoing?
Again, this is one of these vexing public policy issues, because that finding, by the way, is an adjusted finding, meaning that it holds when we control for a range of other factors that would also predict misconduct. And so what I think is going on, actually, is this, particularly for the black officers there, historically anyway. I don't know what it's like now, but historically I think what's going on is when white officers and African-American officers have gotten accused of engaging in misconduct. One of the things I found when I was just digging through the records and doing the initial data collection was that the white officers frequently pled out or admitted to the misconduct. And so instead of getting fired or forced to resign, they'd get 10 days off, or in some cases, the serious cases, 30 days off. African-American officers would often fight the charges. And this is not dissimilar, by the way, to what we find in the general criminal justice arena outside the police department. And I think this is probably because historically maybe a lot of black officers have felt that the NYPD and other departments don't represent their interests as a group of cops. So they're going to fight the charges. And again, not unlike what happens in the criminal justice system, if you fight the charges and force a trial, if you're found guilty, you get hammered.
So what's the answer to that? More diversity within the force?
Well, this is a really interesting finding for me, by the way, because what we found over time was that as the NYPD became more diverse racially and based on gender, the department became better behaved as an entire organizational unit. The rates of misconduct drop as diversity increases. But on the other hand, we still find that there is this pesky result where if you are a black or Latino officer in the department, historically you have a higher probability of getting jammed up.
What about female cops in comparison to male cops?
Female cops, they tended to engage in different kinds of misconduct. Often you would find female cops committing things like welfare fraud or, you know, personal kinds of crimes, you know, for economic purposes.
Didn't you find that military veterans were more likely to be dismissed?
We did find that, and that runs contrary, by the way, to what a lot of police departments and even members of the public might think.
Because they look to vets.
They
feel that they're already comfortable using firearms. Yeah, they understand certain policing methods already.
They understand how to gain compliance through the use of coercion, and that's not always a good job for the police.
So there were all these different theories about the causes of police misconduct. misconduct, the rotten apple theory, the noble cause or Dirty Harry theory, the general strain theory, the social learning theory, the low self-control theory, the police world view theory, the life course theory. Which ones do you think are the most compelling?
For me, I think the two – those are, by the way, those are general theories of criminology.
And your the professor who wrote the foreword said that many of the things that you say in this book could be applied to any organization, Wall Street, professional sports.
I would agree with that too. Yeah, that was Candace McCoy. So for me, the most interesting theoretical explanation for this would be rooted in what you mentioned as self-control issues, and that is that officers who come to the job having had prior problems in their personal and professional lives are the most likely to get into trouble, and that's probably an issue of self-control. And then the learning theory. Some cops come to the job, by the way, and they're doing fine for 5 years, 7 years, but over time they start to socialize with officers who may have sort of deviant perspectives on the job, and they're sort of brought along through a process of maybe differential association or learning, and 20 years down the road, believe it or not, they get fired for misconduct.
Well, they feel frustrated because they're not moving up the ladder while somebody else who joined the force at the same time did. The city moved this year to have all substantiated cases of misconduct tried by attorneys from the Civilian Complaint Review Board instead of the police because they were concerned that the police were being too easy on themselves?
Yeah, this is an interesting issue, by the way, because When you look at the rates of sustained complaints, okay, what we know nationally is that citizen review boards really aren't much better than police departments. In some cases, worse. Sometimes police departments might sustain 17 to 20% of the complaints against officers. This is often a move, what you just described. It's often a move to make the disciplinary process appear to be more legitimate.
My great thanks to Robert J. Kane, who with Michael D. White has written Jammed Up, Bad Cops, Police Misconduct in the New York City Police Department. It's published by NYU Press. It's been a pleasure.
It's great to be here. Thanks.